Welcome to the All About Alts podcast, where we explore the world of alternative investing to help you find financial independence. Join our host, Newview Trust's president, Jason DeBono, as he covers a variety of topics with different guest speakers to discuss tax and alternative investing strategies. It is never too late to start taking control of your financial future, and we are so excited for you to be joining us for this opportunity to hear from some of the best in the business.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the All About Alts podcast. I am your host, Jason DeBono, joined with a good friend for many, many years, Sean Casterline, Delta Advisory. How are you, sir?
Doing great, Jason. How are you, man?
Good, good. And good. You know, a lot of these podcasts, especially with people I've known for many years, it's always hard sometimes to go back and peg a date, but it's got to be 10, 15 years, Sean, that your firm and our firm have been doing some work together.
Yeah, I'll tell you what it was. We actually, we did a series of Dollar General stores back in, I think, 2008 is when we started. So yeah, it's been like 16 years or so. I'm starting to feel a little old now, but yeah, you know.
Okay. Well, time flies. It flies when you're having fun. And, you know, for those that don't know Sean or his firm, I think one of the things that you know, has allowed us to work so closely together over the years is, you know, I think Sean, and I'm going to say this maybe at the risk of it sounding bad or offending others, but Sean was an RIA that loved alternatives before alternatives were cool.
No doubt.
Right.
Good way to put it. Yeah, actually.
You know, and I think now it's becoming more common. And even then, I still think the world of alternatives, you know, it runs the gamut, right? I mean, you can go to a, you know, Morgan Stanley broker and they'll tell you that they can help you with alternatives, but it's going to be the same six or eight large scale funds. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's access to the alternative space. You know, but when we talk about alternatives, and when I say Sean was kind of into alternatives before they were cool, you know, let's talk a little bit about the Dollar General. I mean, I remember, you know, that project that you guys worked on. We had a lot of clients that were part of it, but it was so cool because you could actually see the actual Dollar Generals, right? You could knew the geographic areas. And so it's like, this wasn't just this big triple net lease play that's got 1,000 properties and you'll never figure it out. You know, you were able to really get some hands on. So talk to us a little bit as an RIA and to our listeners, like, you know, that's a registered investment advisor, right? Mm-hmm. So you don't make commissions. Correct. You're paid to provide holistic advice.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Why kind of get so granular in the alternative space?
You know, I think the bigger picture is I myself see the world as much bigger than stocks and bonds, right? I mean, it's not just, you know, mutual funds and the same old, the investment world is much larger. I mean, how many times do you drive down the road and you see a beautiful new apartment complex going up and you're thinking, man, I bet somebody's making money on that, you know? And so we felt like we were different and we were bringing something, you know, different to our investors because we could bring these alternative investments that, you know, traditionally have been, you know, kind of the stomping ground of hedge funds and billionaires. And, you know, and I think as the world has developed, a lot more availability has come to market for alternatives. But, you know, there's no reason anybody should be just kind of pigeonholed into just the traditional stocks and bonds. There's a much bigger investment world out there, you know?
Yeah, I think it, you know, being on the alternative side, you know, my whole career going on 20 years since I got out of school, you know, I've always had a bent towards alternatives. But it wasn't until I kind of understood the Harvard endowment model, right, which has kind of become sort of the poster child, is you've got this, you know, amazing institution where, right, the best and brightest go and the best and brightest give their money back and they invest it. And the endowment model is heavily concentrated to alts. And whereas at the time, I mean, I don't know. You tell me, what was the appropriate concentration or talked about concentration to alts? 3%, 5%?
Yeah, it was pretty low. And again, you know, you see the Harvard Foundation or the endowment, you look at Yale and these guys, and they've got, you know, literally like 70, 75% in alts. Now, a chunk of that's going to be private equity. There's also a huge piece that goes into real estate. You know, I mean, it's, you know, if you want to follow the smartest guys on the planet, that's, you know, that's where you go to look to see what their allocation looks like, you know, and it's exactly what they're doing. You're exactly right.
Well, and we've seen a big shift, you know, and I think you were a real pioneer in that, you know, in terms of being out in front as an advisor, helping clients access some of these alternatives. And I've always, you know, always enjoyed, you know, both our business relationship and friendship because I've appreciated the fact that you think a little bit differently. And I think sometimes in the advisory world, you know, it almost feels like you've just kind of, there's just this shelf of product and it's like, what's the lowest product on the shelf that I can give that's right. The easiest to grab? And sometimes that stuff that's a little higher up that takes a little bit more work to get to and maybe has a little more risk associated with it. Certainly there can be a case made for that. But a lot of advisors weren't even reaching for that. And you were obviously way out in front of that. You know, what sort of alts, you know, maybe at a high level as a from an RIA, what sort of alts, you know, have you seen, you know, how granular have you seen some of the alts that you've been able to help your clients participate in? Let's maybe chat a little bit about that.
You know, I tell you, for us, we've always, you know, the majority of investors have the bulk of their assets in stocks and bonds and traditional capital markets. So from the alternative side, we've always looked for areas that are more defensive. So if you have this pool of general money that's in stocks and bonds and then the economy and is really dependent upon the economy, well, let's add in some real estate that has a negative correlation or a different correlation. And we already mentioned the Dollar General stores. We've done, you know, a series of senior living facilities. We're raising money right now for self-storage. And those three industries are all very defensive by nature. I mean, 2008, Dollar General, I think it's actually Family Dollar, was the top performing stock on the entire S&P 500. You know, and if you think back to 2008 and even like 2020, self-storage was the top performing, you know, asset class according to the NA REIT index. So, you know, we like to add things to people's portfolios that are different, you know, things that run under a different correlation. So if one pool of their money is maybe not working, the real estate side is working or is holding up better. So that's what we strive for. I mean, you're right. I mean, the industry itself sells it, you know, I don't want to name any names, but it's like, yeah, pull the easiest thing off the shelf. I'm getting a 7.5% commission. And that's really kind of the driver, not necessarily looking at the investor's total portfolio in a holistic fashion. You know what I mean? Which I think is really the reason you want to include alts is because they add something different than what you currently have. And so that's the way we've always approached it. We like to bring in things into people's financial world that is going to add value, not just add more of the same.
Well, I love your, you know, the word defensive. And I think sometimes it's a word that feels like you're giving up, not in a bad way. You're not advancing. You're just making sure that you know, nobody advances past you. And I think in the investment world, defensive says, hey, how do I protect yield? Because, right. You know, you can make 20%. And in 2007, no matter what you bought, right, you did. But right, if you weren't defensive in 2008, you lost 40, right?
Yeah, there's no doubt, and a lot more if you're invested heavily in tech, right?
And you so, know. You know, to look at something like Dollar General, you know, real estate, right, which is, you know, it's still real estate at the end of the day. And I think we all tend to paint these kind of investment classes with the same brushstroke, right? Real estate right. Is real estate, stocks are stocks. Real estate, even more so than stocks. And I think there are always winners and losers, right? Not all boats rise in a rising tide or sink, but in the market, it looks that way. In right. Real estate, you got boats moving all the time, right? I mean, look at office space in the last couple of years because of a pandemic, you right. Know, that's a change. But when you look at real estate, like say Dollar General, mm-hmm. That market obviously was very successful, despite the fact that real estate as a whole was having significant challenges. So how do you as a defensive investor mm-hmm. And what guidance do you have for our listeners today? You know, when you're trying to make return, but be defensive, what are some of the parameters that you look for, things that you consider and factors that you're kind of working through when making those decisions?
Well, I think the first thing you want to look at is, you know, the correlation of these industries to the broader economy. So it's very easy to see that, you know, when we go into recession, people don't pull their things out of self-storage. They have no place to put them, right? So when you look at the industry, it does tend to have a, you know, I'd say is a negative correlation or a low correlation to general economic growth. You know, senior living is the same. I mean, right now, we got 10,000 baby boomers a day turning 65. You know, that's not something that is going to be dependent upon the economy, whether or not seniors need senior living. Right. And, you know, again, with Dollar General, same thing. It, you know, even within the alt space, if you look at all the variations of retail, you know, certainly the dollar stores are more defensive. Malls are not, you know, malls are dependent upon population and economy. And now Amazon is the ultimate mall, you know? So I think, you know, there, if you look within these industries, when you say storage, well, there's a huge difference between Class D self-storage that was built 30 years ago and Class A self-storage that's much more well-positioned today. So I think part of it is, hey, look at the correlations of that, you know, real estate class to the broader economy, but also dissect the levels within that, you know what I mean, within that area, because retail is not retail. You know, senior living is not senior living. If it's a Medicaid-driven facility, it's not like a self-pay type facility. So you do have to dissect it a little bit, you know, from the industry itself.
And that's a really good point. And I think one that maybe we can, you know, kind of talk a little bit more on the idea of looking at industries inside of industries, right? And retail, you gave such a great example, and it's somewhat, the irony is there, because no less than 2 hours ago, I was talking to someone about malls and right. what was happening with malls. Yeah. And what they were doing. And you know, we're going to talk a little bit about self-storage, and I'm familiar with some of the stuff you guys are doing to repurpose some retail into right. self-storage, which is super cool. And we'll get to that. But even industries within industries, right? I mean, I think we've all, as investors and individuals, been in a very interesting part of the market and this game, right? Because I think we all have a little bit, or those of us that are old enough to remember, we have this kind of PTSD around 2007, right? Which is entered into the Great Recession, and everything went up really fast and down really fast.
Right.
And then now fast forward, we have the longest bull run we've ever had, right? So everyone kind of feels like, well, that at some point the shoe's got to drop. COVID hits, and you'd think, well, the world shut down. Here comes economic disaster. No. Right. Fast forward, we survived the pandemic, right? And it seems like things are getting back to normal. And now we've got, massive inflation. So let's shoot up interest rates, the fastest they've ever gone up. Well, here goes another recession, right? And here we are. It's like, at some point, like, holy cow, the resiliency of just the overall market has been crazy. So I think we're all watching, thinking, this game, we're in overtime. We're in double overtime. Now we're in triple overtime.
Yeah.
Where do you see us? And I'm not asking you to forecast, especially as an RIA. I know that goes probably against the grain. But just as a generalist, you know, what are you seeing as it relates to just where the heck are we in this game? And are we on borrowed time, or, you know, maybe is this game going to go longer than we all thought?
You know, I think, you know, just from our perspective, you know, going into 2023, all the talking heads were saying we're going into recession, right? Higher interest rates, we're going into recession. And we didn't. Matter of fact, in the third quarter, the economy grew 5%. And that's huge. I mean, for the U.S. economy, it's like a battleship. Trying to move it is difficult. You know, then I started hearing, well, we're going to go into recession in 2024. Well, we're not. I mean, you know, the economy is certainly slowing a little bit right now, but not to the extent that it would be indicating recession. And the fact is, the Fed signaled this year they're going to lower rates 3 times, you know, and they didn't lower in March. I know Goldman Sachs came out and said, hey, we're expecting them to start in March. They're gonna lower 3 times this year. They're gonna lower more in 2025. So, you know, my crystal ball ran out of batteries a long time ago, so I can't really predict the exact economy. But I can tell you things are good economically. And when the Fed starts lowering the rates, if the 10-year continues to come down, should be prime for real estate, because real estate's really kind of been in a funk, as you mentioned, for the last 18 months. You know, but you know, that's the time you want to get in, when the opportunities are around you, you know?
Yeah, it is interesting. You know, we have seen things go down. We have seen real estate prices come down. And I think for a lot of real estate prices, it's actually a good thing. You know, certainly when you look at residential real estate, you know, there is an element of affordability that markets, I won't say need to have, because that's a relative term in terms of what's affordable, but I don't think any real estate investor will ever say we want 20% returns. We're all really happy in the 5-7% range with cash flow and some upside. It makes it harder, believe it or not, you know, those listening, it's harder to invest in these crazy markets, whether they run up or run down. So, very interesting kind of time that we're in. And, you know, from a real estate standpoint, certainly you've got markets inside of markets inside of markets that have all performed inherently different over the last 18 months. We actually recorded a podcast with an attorney, and we were chatting about kind of the NARS settlement as it relates to commissions, and mm-hmm. just, you know, maybe throwing that in because of a little bit of recency syndrome around that discussion the recent settlement and kind of ruling that came down around how real estate commissions are paid. How do you see that impacting the real estate market, if at all, or if so, where and to what degree?
You know, I think it's going to curb the bottom side, meaning the newer people coming into real estate, right? I think, you know, down the road, much like you saw a shortage of, pilots and nurses and all this after COVID, I think it's going to curb the newer people coming in. I think established people in that industry, yeah, they're going to continue to do business. They're going to continue to make money. And certainly people who are uber successful continue to do well. But, you know, again, something like that where you start messing with comp with people, it's such a big draw to the real estate industry. And I think, again, a lot of people who are in college, you know, thinking, hey, maybe I'll go into real estate, might think twice, you know, might go to the development side or go to the commercial side as opposed to, you know, residential sales or something like that. So, you know, it remains to be seen. But, you know, obviously we all know people that are, you know, broker real estate in the real estate game, and, you know, they're certainly not happy about it. And I know a few that might be shifting careers, you know. So,
yeah. Change is always interesting, and it'll be, yes. you know, curious to see how that plays out and ultimately what ripple effect it may or may not have. I want to talk self-storage because, you know, it's one of those topics I think a lot of people hear about. We see it, we drive by it, we probably, have stuff parked inside one or two as it relates today. But you guys are doing some pretty cool stuff on the self-storage side that I really want to get to. But I'm gonna leave that there for just a quick second. Sure. Amy's coming around with the envelopes for the quirky questions. So we're going to throw you on the hot seat before right. we get to the self-storage side. So thank you, Amy. All right. If you are ready, we've got our quirky questions. Again, thank you to our listeners that keep submitting these. All about alts at newviewtrust.com. There are no wrong answers, Sean. So have fun at it. Here we go. If you could have any fictional character as your best friend, who would it be?
Fictional character as my best friend. I think it'd have to be Superman, right? I mean, do all, you know, good dude. You know, he could fly me to France for dinner, you know, whatever it is. I mean, yeah, I think it'd have to be probably Superman. I don't know. You know, I was initially thinking Peter Pan. I have no idea why. I'm thinking maybe because he never grows up. And I don't want to. So...
Interesting. Well, if you could have one on each side, you'd have the best of both worlds, I suppose. No. But I do like the superhero. I think, yeah, you nailed it. You get the best of all worlds.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. I mean, maybe you can pass on a little some of that strength, you know?
Wouldn't that be nice?
That would be nice.
All right, Sean. Question number two. Salad or a sandwich?
Salad. I'm religious salad. The thing is, if I eat a sandwich and go back to the office, I'm just, you know, in your gut, sleepy. So there's no question. I mean, the guys at the office laugh. They go get lunch. They grab me a salad every time. So, you know, I'm a salad guy, 100%, you know.
All right.
Keep the energy up.
Good for you. I need to be more of a salad guy is part of my problem.
There's plenty of room on the bandwagon. Come join me.
You know, and I do have to say, I think the problem I have is when I do eat salads, it defeats the whole purpose because I've littered them with enough unhealthy stuff.
Yeah, right.
I'm kind of getting away from the salad thing, but yeah, I am working on that. It's been a resolution. I haven't given up completely on it, but I'm certainly won't declare success. This is a good one. If you had to give up one of your senses, mm-hmm. which one are you giving up?
Oh my gosh, that is a tough one. Let me see. Definitely not sight. Right. Definitely not smelling, taste, maybe touch. Yeah, I guess. I think that would be the right one. That or taste. I don't know. Taste is too important. I mean, you got to hear people. That's a tough one. I think touch maybe, you know,
okay.
I'd probably burn my fingers off. But
I'm rifling through them all myself. There's obviously no great answer to that. You're giving something up that's available to you today. I think the thing, you know, my understanding is that if you, whether you're born without one or lose one, that it actually heightens all the other ones.
I've heard that.
Yeah. So interesting. So you give up the touch and then, man, them taste buds, you may not be a salad guy anymore.
I know. Just put ribeye on top of my salad. That's all.
Well, that'd be a good problem to have. Well, John, you're off the hot seat, man. Thank you, Jason. Thanks for having some fun with us on that. Always one of my favorite parts of the show. That whoever asked that that last one, there's been some good ones, but that thing's still rolling through my head. I'm gonna wake up thinking about it.
Gold star for that person. That was a good one. That's a tough one.
Well, let's talk self-storage, right? You know, and I think we all understand, and maybe I'm being a little presumptuous. I mean, people understand the general premise of storage, right? You're basically paying to externally store something, right? Or a series of somethings. But man, you know, you mentioned kind of you've got these 30-year-old, we'll call them mom and pop type self-storage facilities. Right. You've got these massive facilities. You've got redevelopment, you know, which I know is something that's big for you guys. What is kind of the world of self-storage from your lens? Maybe not for the whole market, but just from your lens, what do you kind of box around or is your avatar as it relates to self-storage?
You know, the nice thing about self-storage, as you mentioned, it's a very easy business to understand. You know, I mean, you're talking, my partner, Bill Johnson, always jokes. He's like, yeah, it's like 3 men in a truck. I mean, you have 3 employees, you turn on the lights and people bring their stuff. It's just, you know, you don't have to have overhead of, you know, millions of dollars. It's a cash flow business. And as you mentioned before, that's very important that we deliver that to our investors, because it's not always about, you know, 20-30% returns. It's about getting cash flow from the real estate. So, you know, for us, we're building them throughout the Southeast. They're Class A self-storage properties. You and I talked earlier, we're working on a third Kmart conversion. But, you know, self-storage is interesting because there's a lot of commonality with multifamily. You know, when we're looking at properties, we're looking at what residential is being built. We're looking for Publix. You know, they're always well-placed. I mean, I say that kind of jokingly, kind of not. But, you know, in the South, you've got 10,000 baby boomers turning 65 a day. That's going to continue for like 15 more years. And, you know, you got 1,200 people a day moving to the state of Florida, you know, and the same thing, about 900 people a day moving to Georgia. And so when people in the Northeast, or the Midwest, they retire, you know, they buy a condo down in Sarasota, they downsize the size of their residence, but they don't necessarily get rid of their stuff. I mean, they're Americans. We love our stuff, you know. So they bring, you know, grandma's china cabinet with them and they put it in storage. And that's a simple driver, you know, behind self-storage. It's a very easy industry to understand. But I think the potential for self-storage, because of this big demographic shift, because, you know, the southern states are also business friendly. And all these office spaces we see, you know, where's all that the office furniture going? It's going into storage. You know, so there's a lot of things in the industry that are kind of driving storage, or a lot of things in the economy that are driving storage. But, you know, that's one of the things that really attracted us to it. One was the defensive nature. B was the fact that we can easily understand it. You know, C, Investopedia has numbers out. They say that 50% of new businesses fail within the first 5 years. In self-storage, 92% of businesses are successful in that five-year window. And banks recognize that. And banks will finance self-storage, you know. So that's kind of in a nutshell what we see now and what we were attracted to.
Well, you know, let's talk a little bit about these Kmarts, right? Because this is something that I think a lot of real estate investors, developers, you know, and I'll share an example on just even the residential side. You know, we tend to look at people that flip houses, right? And we're like, well, they're just driving the prices up. It's like driving the prices up. They just took a house that was dilapidated, that nobody liked. It was an eyesore. And they went in and they put in sweat equity. They built it, right? They made it look better. They made it a better contributor to society, to the neighborhood. And for that, they got profit off of it. Why in the world is that a problem? Like, we've all driven by the empty Sears and Kmart buildings in any city, town, or, you know, or a municipality that we roll through. And let's be honest, not one of them do we look at and go, well, that's nostalgic. I'm glad it's there. It looks great. We all go, when's something going to happen? And you guys kind of created a little niche in going in and actually doing it. You've done what, third one? So let's talk a little bit about that. So you've got this, you know, empty shell of a Kmart, right? Which is a little bit of all of our childhoods, certainly. What are you doing? What is that, you know, opportunity? Why there instead of the lot right next door that's just grass?
Well, you know, with Kmarts, the interesting part is the ones that we've bought are all steel buildings. And so from a storage perspective, that's a big expense when you're building one ground up. So we're going to save about $3 million, you know, by buying a Kmart building. You know, Kmarts were typically on major roads, you know, well-placed. You know, the one we did in Jacksonville, we had to put a new roof on it. So it's a little bit more expensive, but just to give you an example, you know, a typical Class A brand new self-storage facility is probably going to cost around $12.5 million. If it's a Kmart conversion, we're going to get it done in probably 9.5 to 10. So it's a pretty big cost savings. And again, you know, another thing that we benefit from is these big parking lots, right? So the one we converted in Panama City Beach, there's so much unmet demand and it filled so fast. We built another self-storage building right next to it, you know, so it's double. And, you know, in Jacksonville, we sold off some lots, and Sebring, it's a big, you know, we haven't sold off lots yet because we haven't built it, but yeah, that's another great opportunity to kind of cash flow and bring money back to the project or back to our investors.
Well, you know, and the more time I spend understanding how real estate as a whole works, the more impressed I get. And, you know, I think for most of us, you know, we would never think that a Kmart could be repurposed, right? Right. And even if you told us it could be repurposed, we go, okay, well, I get it. There's a shell there and you kind of fill up the inside. And I would not have thought about the fact that the parking lot can be repurposed and those are out parcels. And, you know, these are all drivers, whether they're cash flow or whether they're helping offset the cost of the development. There's so many different drivers and avenues in the real estate market to make money. Let's talk on the self-storage side. You know, occupancy across self-storage, very high, right?
Right.
Despite everything else going on in real estate, right? Still driving very high. What do you see kind of propping that demand up and keeping that? And in the event that we do see some economic slowdown, what do you see? People aren't accumulating as much new stuff. Do you see that having impact on self-storage?
You know, I don't. I think, you know, one of the things, there's really two things we see that drive self-storage right now, really kind of three, but the baby boomers, millennials are heavy users of self-storage. I mean, to the tune of like 50%, right? They want these tiny houses and they want to be mobile, but they still want their stuff. So they're heavy users of self-storage. And again, the business side, I think more and more businesses, you know, we built one up in St. Cloud, this was a couple of years ago, but we were visiting the facility and there was some people that worked, they're like alligator catchers for the city of St. Cloud. And there's a lake next to our facility and we just happened to be there. We're talking to them. We're like, yeah, you trapping a gator over there. They're like, no, this is our self-storage facility. So they're storing all their stuff as opposed to going out and buying a building or building it, you know? And so, you know, in America in the last 15 years, I think we've got like 1.5 million fewer businesses, but there's like 10 or 15% more usage of self-storage on the commercial side, you know? So again, I think those are kind of the drivers going forward. I think, you know, with any real estate, doesn't matter if you're building apartments or if you're building, you know, retail or you're building self-storage or senior living, if there's unmet demand in that market, it's going to fill, you know what I mean? I mean, you're going to be able to build and have a successful outcome for that piece of real estate. So I hear people talking about, yeah, maybe real estate's, you know, in a multi-year downtrend or, yeah, not really, you know, I mean, because the stuff we've built that we've opened up in the last year is filling very quickly. You know, rates have softened a little bit in the last year, but that's after a huge spike up after 2020. So it's normal. It's going to settle a little bit, you know what I mean? But no, I think going forward, I mean, storage is going to do well. And we're well placed for the economy and where it is.
Well, I can't help but catch the alligator trapping, you know, and Sean is a fellow Floridian as well. I think those listening outside the state are probably, you know, gasping like, what's an alligator catcher?
Yeah. It's a shark catcher, but with on the land. Yeah.
There you go. But you know, it'd be really hard to refute, you know, the thesis around self-storage. You know, and certainly there's some smaller markets or different markets that may experience different trends, but you're right. I mean, I heard a guy one time and he said, we're Americans, we accumulate shit.
Yeah. And you're like, we love our stuff.
Yeah. And they're like, I don't know what it is, but you open up a storage unit, you know, and you're like, there's stuff. And you open the next one and you're like, there's more of it. And But you know, I did not understand until you said it, and thank you for sharing kind of the trend on the commercial side. Right. You know, I know some use cases of, you know, people that can't store, you know, trailers at their house. And so they have they run a sprinkler business and they go at the end of the night or their pool business and they throw their trailer in there. And instead of having a facility, they've got stuff on the walls where they've got all their parts and they park their trailer. And every morning they go and grab it all. And it's significantly less expensive than any alternative available to store it. The other thing that I've heard is that, you know, buying those facility, you know, finding another place to store it outside, you know, a lot of these open trailers with lawn equipment, this stuff is ripe for theft. And so being able to open a door, back it in, take it off the trailer, pull it down and lock it, you know, and do it for less money in a more secure environment. So I could certainly see that as also being drivers.
Yeah, I'll tell you another piece about that. So like, for example, the Ocoee project we just opened in December has a giant high-speed garage door. So our renters can use their phone to open the garage door. They drive in, it's all climate controlled, and then they can drive through the other side. And that's who uses it, is it's all the landscapers, the pool guys, so they can drop their stuff off, safety, you know, in air conditioning at night, day, morning, it doesn't matter. But, you know, again, that's one of the reasons I think more and more, you know, Class A facilities are putting in larger units on the bottom, you know, and to be able to access them through, you know, and when drive through a garage and just drop stuff off is just so convenient, you know?
Absolutely. And speaking of convenience, I mean, I think that's something that, you know, positioning of these facilities is so critical because, you know, and maybe you can help me. There's a very tight radius, right? Mm-hmm. That people want. If you're a landscape, you know, if you run a landscape business, you don't want to drive 8 miles to go get your trailer. So even though supply has its ability to come up, I don't want to save $20 to go to, you know, down the road because I drive it every single morning and every single night. It needs to be convenient. No different than, you know, there's 4 gas stations on both sides of the road because I'm not making a U-turn for fuel.
Right. It's a good point. Yeah. Well, you know, and for us, we run all of our demographic studies within 3 miles. So, yeah, I mean, if, you know, somebody could save $100 a month, maybe they'll drive 5, but, you know, you're right. You're exactly right. I mean, we want to look at, you know, what the competition looks like within our 3 mile perimeter. We want to look at rates. We want to look at square foot per capita, which is probably the biggest metric in our business. You know, we want square foot per capita to be under 10. And that'd be a good market to look at. We also look at the competition. We built a facility in Aiken, South Carolina, and there was a lot of competition in the marketplace, but none of it was climate controlled and it was all just old. And so even though, you know, we saw a lot of competition, it wasn't competition for us. And that facility filled up in like 8 months, you know? So, you know, you definitely have to look close to home because people aren't going to drive 20 miles to drop self-storage, you know?
Yeah, no, very, very true on the convenience side. So let's talk a little bit about numerics, not necessarily in terms of financials for returns, but, you know, you mentioned 8 months to lease up. What is a project look like? And let's use the Kmart example. You know, what from the time that you're ready to act on that and you've underwritten it, you know, what does that life cycle look like to where you're ready to get your first, you know, person dropping their trailer or whatever it may be at the facility? Yeah.
You know, for a Kmart conversion, it's really going to be 8 to 10 months. I mean, you know, again, the vertical construction is mostly complete. If you're talking about a ground up development, it's about 12 months. You know, COVID was obviously a different animal. You know, we had trouble getting a elevator in Augusta, Georgia. We had trouble getting electrical panels for Ocoee. But now we're kind of through that. You know, pricing for steel's come down quite a bit. So it's not what it was back in 22. But yeah, typically about 12 months to build a new facility, you know, once the property is entitled and permitted. And, you know, we run our pro formas on the fill for 2 years. And I think the industry, it's really kind of industry standard to do that. You know, in the last couple of years, we filled them faster. But, you know, again, we run our financials off of 2 years. And once you're full, I mean, you know, between 60 and 70%, you're paying off, you know, the operational expenses, you're paying off all the debt and the investors. And the rest is just profit. But I will tell you this, self-storage is operationally profitable at 29% occupancy. Think about that number, 29% occupancy, you know, and then that's paying for the lights, it's paying for the employees. And I mean, again, once you get to that 60 to 70%, it's just all cash flow, You know, it's just all cash flow. But, you know, going back to the original question, typically about a year to build them, you know.
Well, you know, and that 29% number, I mean, that just jumps out. I mean, if you look at any other real estate deal and, you know, and when you underwrite it, and I think this is where commercial, you know, type assets, you know, mm-hmm. people love them versus something like residential is a one-to-one play, you know,
right.
Now ease of access and, you know, barriers to entry are significantly lower, but right. on the commercial side, you know, diversification just amongst your own one singular product, is there. So 29% to be, you know, to turn the lights on, 65% ish to start making money, man, that's right. a nice window.
It is.
So, you know, you guys manage and have a fund available for people to enter into the self-storage space, right? To these okay. assets mm-hmm. that we're talking about. What's the goal, you know, and every fund is different, right? Some mm-hmm. they want to build and hold, some they want to build and flip, some they want to build and do, who else knows what may be worthwhile, but what is right. kind of the goal, you know, Sean, for you and as you guys kind of develop this investment thesis, how are you kind of working against that? And what are the benchmarks that you're setting inside to hit?
So we're looking to build somewhere in that 50 range and then have a liquidity event for investors, right? So we've got 12 open operational, we're under construction, 5 more, and we have 10 more behind that. So we're pretty well along the process. You know, goal is to deliver cash flow to investors, give them some upside. 3 to 5 years would be the time frame. And, you know, once we get through that time frame, we're not done. I mean, we plan on going back and reproducing it again. But, you know, of all the alternatives I've done, people want returns and they want their money back, you know. So we want to make sure within a reasonable time we're having a good experience for investors. We're getting their money back to them. And then we're going to ask them, hey, do you want to go do it again? You know, but the goal is not, you know, 20 years or 10 years.
Awesome. Well, it sounds like you're almost halfway there in terms of kind of what's already in the pipeline, and that's an amazing accomplishment. What challenges have interest rates played over the last, you know, 3 years in this process? Because you went from you know, being able to get loans, you know, really for pennies, certainly historically, and now, you know, you're not paying pennies any longer. How has that changed the underwriting process, and what are you seeing? And then, you know, is there a little bit of luck in timing, or is there a little bit of skill in timing about exiting and interest rates, you know, on a go forward basis?
You know, no, you're exactly right. We worked with Ladder on the debt for the first 5 that we acquired, or that we, you know, took out at CO back in 21. And, you know, the rates were very reasonable. We then went and brought in a private equity partner called Rialto, and they brought in a debt line with Natixis. And at that time, the debt line was 4.75%. And we could hit it, you know, up to $140 million pretty much whenever we wanted. Well, all of a sudden, interest rates skyrocket, and exactly what you said, a much more challenging environment. And that rate with Natixis became just, you know, something that was unreasonable. So, you know, for the last year, it's been very hard to even approach, you know, banks and financial companies about debt. You know, one of our staples has been kind of regional banks or local banks. And at this point, they're just not loaning. So recently, we signed a deal with Beal Bank as the senior loan. Crow is bringing in Mez. And literally, that's happening now. We're going through details. But it's been 9 months of work to get there. You know what I mean? So one of the things we're also seeing because of rates going up is other developers that don't have, you know, what I would call size or scale, can't get debt. And so they're coming to market selling, you know, entitled properties. You know, we have developers calling us every week saying, hey, I got a piece of property, it's entitled, ready to go. Do you want it? You know, so I think the amount of construction and self-storage that's coming out of the ground right now is a fraction of what it was in 2018, 2019. And that is strictly because of, you know, interest rates and what we've seen in that space. You know, a lot of people think, you know, they see a bunch of self-storage popping up. They think, well, maybe the industry's gotten overbuilt, because there was a big spike in 18 and 19. But since then, the trend has gone down dramatically for a number of economic reasons. But interest rates is the biggest one. You know, people just can't get loans.
Well, you know, and you highlighted kind of I think we tend to look at when, you know, the challenges, and you run a business, right? Whether that's on the RIA side, whether it's on the development side, whether it's on the fund management side, or on the custody side, right? Businesses right. will always have challenges, and sometimes challenges are internal, right? We got to figure this out. This is our problem. And then they're external, right? This is a right. marketplace condition, but either way, we still have to figure it out. I think, you know, I really appreciate you kind of answering it the way you did, which is, hey, yeah, we get it. Rates went up. It created challenges. But at the same time, challenges, if positioned right, can create opportunities. And it right. sounds like, you know, what our listeners, you know, may or may not have heard through your answer there is that, yeah, we're going to pay more for debt, but I'm able to go get land from developers that already went through all the process, which is time, energy, and money to entitle it, that yep. I didn't have to. And there's so, you know, pick your poison, right? Because you're yep. you're benefiting in one area and you're paying a premium in another. So that's definitely something.
And consider too, Jason, with that, I mean, if you can get debt today and you expect rates to come down, right, then you can also refi or recap your projects, but you won't have the opportunity to do more construction at a time where nobody's doing construction, right? You know what I mean? So the yep. opportunity is now. It has been a tough environment for commercial real estate and for self-storage because of rates. But man, if you can get things going now, it's like buying at the bottom of a bear market, you know?
Yep. And you know, I had a real estate mentor said, in real estate, interest rates never last forever. So, you know, right. the beauty is it's the one thing that you're always get to be on the right side of, because you may not be on the right side today, but if they right. go down, you get on the right side. If yep. they go up, you just hedged your own bet, right? Right. It's the one thing that really is a hedge on your own deal, is the interest rate that you pay. So that's certainly a valuable tool for many people. 100%. For people that are out there, you know, kind of, let's say, sitting on the sidelines, right? And we're not fans of that. We preach that a lot on this show is, you know, be patient. Right. And sometimes, yes, the best place to be is the sideline, but not permanently. Don't get too comfortable there. You're not going to time a market correctly. You're not, you know, there's so many studies. If you go back and if you'd have invested in 2007 at the height, you actually would likely be doing better. It, mm-hmm. based on the normal flow of investments than if you started in 2008 or if you went in 2005, because you got the run up. So, you right. know, there's just so many scenarios. What, you know, as an RIA, right, who manages hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars over mm-hmm. your career, but also as a very smart real estate investor and developer on large scale, what do you say to the people sitting on the sidelines today about, again, maybe where we are, where opportunity lies?
You know, I think, and I was talking to an investor a few weeks ago, and he's got a bunch of money in CDs, you know, and he's like, well, I'm getting 5.25% in a CD. And I asked him, I said, well, how long is your CD for? And he's like, well, 7 months. I'm like, okay, but what happens when rates go down? And, you know, you've seen the yield curve, even though it's inverted, the best returns have gone shorter and shorter. I mean, last year was 18 months. Now it's like 7. So I think, you know, sitting on the sideline, not taking action, yeah, you might get, you know, 5% out of a money market, but you were getting 5.5% last year. And that number is going to continue to drop. And if you're doing CDs, the same. So I think by not getting off the sideline at a time where commercial real estate is as attractive as it's been for quite some time, it's just an opportunity cost. You know, you can't be afraid to pull the trigger, because you'll always be afraid to pull the trigger. You know, the markets will go back up and you'll be like, oh, things are too good. And they go back down. You're like, well, you know, things aren't very good. I'll wait for them to get better. And you just kind of play that cycle. And I think, you know, if you're being cautious and you've got some opportunities you're evaluating is one thing, but to purposely, you know, stay in cash, it'll end up biting you in the end. You know, it's not going to last longer, you know, longer term, you know?
Yeah, well, I love analogizing any sort of investment, you know, to blackjack, right, or right. to gambling. And you know, if you think about it, you know, you can have a stack of chips and you can hold them off on the side. There's a lot of hands that are going to be played while you're sitting on the sidelines, you may see some losing hands in a row and feel like you got out of the way. But there's also going to be winning hands that you're right. not going to get to be part of, and so. You know, there just is no right time. It's be smart, do due diligence, you know, think about it. I think, you know, Sean gave some really good tips on the defensive side, right? Buy assets that position you if there is a downside to be protected while not giving up on the upside. So, Sean, it's been awesome having you on the show. I love the discussion on self-storage and really, you know, I mean it when I say you really were way out in front of your peers in terms of, you know, being a true RIA and financial advisor with fiduciary responsibilities, yet not walking your clients away from some of the more granular level alts they could kind of see, touch and feel, maybe to tie that census question back in from the Corky questions. But it is, it's been really cool to see along the way. And I think your story on the self-storage side that you guys are kind of starting to write now is definitely an interesting one.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it very much. I appreciate your partnership over the years. I mean, we've had a long relationship and, you know, love working the New View. So you've been able to kind of see the things we've done. But, you know, the world's much bigger than, you know, money markets and stocks and bonds. That's why we've always loved alts. And, you know, I think, you know, we think we're in a really good space right now. But there's a lot of defensive forms of real estate that people can look at, and certainly have to be happy to be a resource for anybody that hears this, that they want to have a conversation.
Yeah, we'll make sure to throw your contact info there. If you want to pick his brain as an RIA, I'd encourage you to do that. If you want to pick his brain on the real estate side, it's not just self-storage. You know, his experience spans a lot of different real estate development, redevelopment, that sort of thing. So, Sean, we're not going to let you go without one last question. Season two, our wrap-up question for every show is straightforward, but an important one. So, Sean, what keeps you up at night?
You know what keeps me up at night? I would say my kids, you know, not a whole lot. I mean, there's been times where things have been stressful on the real estate side, you know, but, I look at some of the institutional relationships we put together, and it gives me a lot of confidence that when there are tough economic times, we've got a great team and a great offering. So I don't, you know, worry quite as much about the business side, quite honestly. My boys are crazy, you know, and I that's the biggest thing. And business wise, I'm pretty excited about where we are, both from the RIA side and on the real estate side. But you're always kind of looking for the shoe to drop on the markets. And, you know, that does have me thinking quite a bit. So I'll wake up and make some notes during the middle of the night, you know?
Yeah. Well, it sounds like anyone with kids in a business, there's no shortage of things to keep you up at night, I'm glad to hear it's not as much on the business side.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt.
Well, Sean, thanks again for being here. Best of luck as you guys continue to build out, you know, your investment strategy and philosophy for your clients. If you want to reach out to Sean, take a look at the show notes and his contact info is there. I'd encourage you to do that where it makes sense. We'll wrap things up. As always, hit the like, share, subscribe button. We're always eager to keep growing our community of investors and people just looking to do more in the alternative space. And as always, hopefully save as much as they can on the tax implications alongside those alternative investments. So we'll see you guys all next week. Sean, thanks again for being here. Great to see you.
Thanks, Jason. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for listening. We hope the information within this podcast has given you the tools that you need to find your way to financial independence. We would love to partner with you on this journey. Text ALTS, that's ALTS, to 407-708-1853 to learn more about how to get started today. Don't forget to follow us to make sure you don't miss a second of content, and we'll see you next week.